Okay, it's time for the Big Picture program now, and joining us once again on the line, this time from within the borders of South Africa, we welcome Brother Buka Dawji. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You sound better when you're in South Africa.
Alhamdulillah, but after that 9.5 hour journey from Turkey to Johannesburg, I could only manage 2 hours on the treadmill this morning.
Well, at least you still haven't taken your surfboard. Anyway, you told us about your visit to Croatia last week. After that, you were heading to Bosnia. What did you do in Bosnia?
Yes, well, as I said, Croatia is beautiful beyond description. The waterways, the mountains surrounding, the villages, everywhere like a picture postcard. And so we entered Bosnia, a Muslim-majority country in the heart of Europe. But wait, Croatia is right next door to Bosnia. How come Croatia did not become Muslim? Well, as I said last week, there are some Muslims there, but mainly around Zagreb and Dubrovnik, where we met that amazing imam. Well, I learned something really interesting, interesting information from a taxi driver. Apparently, the Ottomans came to the whole region. That was, of course, a long time ago. They occupied both Croatia and Bosnia. The people in Bosnia who were Christian became Muslims, but the king of Bosnia was asked if his people would like to become Muslim or pay the jizya. And they opted to pay the jizya, and for hundreds of years they paid the jizya and were under the protection of the Muslims. And there was peace and harmony, which continues right up to this day. As I said last week, mutual respect. Now that's a fascinating story which I will be looking into. So we entered Bosnia, and first stop on our way to Sarajevo was Mostar, as I told you last week, where due to the lack of time I had to cancel my intention to dive off this beautiful ancient bridge, the arched bridge. My group was in a hurry to get to Sarajevo and deprived me of this opportunity. What a selfish lot. And so we reached Sarajevo. Best thing, halal chow joints everywhere. And next day we entered a beautiful ancient masjid right in the middle of the town for Jummah Salah, alhamdulillah, and full of retos, all whiteys, all tall, blonde and blue-eyed. Sarajevo is quaint. The town center is a fascinating place full of small shops and cobblestone streets, the whole area, mainly for pedestrians. And so that's just one word to describe it, quaint. Very beautiful indeed, and the city is surrounded by mountains. Again, a picture postcard. And everywhere I was told, everywhere, and this was what I was told, because I strictly ensure that my gaze is permanently lowered, Maulana. Everywhere are very nice-looking ladies wearing colorful scarves and hijabs, and some, of course, dress in modern clothes, so I was told. But let me give you some highlights. Everyone, including some bullies who I thought couldn't make it, got into half a dozen rubber duckies, those large inflatable boats, and raced down the Neretva River. This is white water rafting. They were screaming and laughing with shouts of, "Ay, Allah, Allah," and woo. As they went over the small waterfalls, rowing frantically over the rapids. Incidentally, Maulana, one day I will take you on this white water rafting, but as I told you, there's probably a technical problem there that we'll have to sort out. So, all great fun. Let finish downstream with a great braai of fish and steaks and chicken and so on. All halal, of course. Another fascinating site that I didn't visit, on my trip last year was a bunker. Now, our bus came to a normal looking house, came in front of a normal looking house on the side of a mountain. It didn't look any different from other homes in the area. Just plain and simple. But when we entered, we were knocked out. Let me give you some background information. Joseph Broz Tito was the leader of Yugoslavia, which was, of course, made up of Croatia, Bosnia, Montenegro, Kosovo, Serbia, and so on. He was afraid that there would be a nuclear attack on his country. An atomic bomb would be dropped. So he ordered the building of a secret bunker near the town of Cognac. The project started in 1953 and was only completed in 1979, which is a period of 26 years, at a total cost of $4.6 billion. Yes, 4.6, and that was a huge amount of money at that time. And so we entered this network of tunnels, big tunnels, corridors. It was like the underground train tunnels in the London subway. Huge corridors covering a total of 6,500 square meters. It had everything in it. And it was like an underground town, sleeping quarters, storage rooms, conference rooms, huge air filtration plants, massive electricity generators, dining rooms, staff quarters, communication rooms, VIP quarters for Tito and his family. And it would take hours to visit the whole place. Our quick guided tour itself took more than 1.5 hours. Everything was still in place. Old telex machines and telephones, beds and couches, all of them brand new, unused. The place was to be stocked with food that would keep people supplied for 6 months. No need to go outside. Huge thick steel doors all over the place would make the bunker airtight. What was it for? Well, in the event of an unexpected atomic bomb attack or an expected atomic bomb attack on Yugoslavia, Tito and 350 of his top generals would be safely protected in this bunker for at least 6 months, together with hundreds of other staff who would take care of various duties to ensure that the 350 are taken care of and that the world knows that they have the government is still secure underground and has survived. What a place. We were totally fascinated. But here's the punchline. There is no evidence that Tito actually visited the place. He died a year after it was completed. And everybody had one thought in their minds in my group, which they, of course, expressed, that you can be in the deepest, most fortified bunker, but if Malakal Moth wants to reach you, you got no chance at all. And one more thing. We were told that Tito also built an underground airport somewhere in Croatia. Now, that would be something worth seeing. So next April, all of you join me as we find out how can there be an underground airport? Completely bizarre. And dear listeners, the highlight of the trip, or should I say the most heart-wrenching, incredibly sad part of our tour, was the town of Srebrenica. As our bus stopped at the site where a massacre took place in 1995, many in the group were shocked into silence. 8,300 small white pillars dotted the landscape, bearing the names of men, women and children massacred by the Serbs. Here's the short story of what happened. Serbs attacked Muslims all over Bosnia. When they attacked villages around Srebrenica, the people ran into Srebrenica. 40,000 in all became, because the United Nations declared this area a safe zone, a safe area, and they stationed Dutch troops there. The Serbs surrounded the town and began bombing it from the hills. Then they came in, and the Dutch soldiers gave up completely. Many women were raped and brutally killed. Oof, I read some graphic accounts, too chilling for words. Then women and very small children were sent out of the camp. They were separated from the men, and they were put into a fleet of buses. And then the killings began. The men were taken out and systematically shot, some in the surrounding forest, some behind these huge buildings where they were imprisoned. Bodies were buried in mass graves all over the area. When the Serb commanders realized that they could be charged with war crimes, bulldozers were used to dig up these badly decomposed bodies. So they were all torn, these bodies were torn to pieces, and body parts were then all mixed up, and then they were reburied in other distant places, places that are still being discovered even today. But it's hard to identify who they are. If you find if you find just messed up bones, how can you identify? So families today, they've given samples of their DNA. Some skin is scraped, and then all the pieces that are found are checked to see if they match with the DNA, which is, of course, a long, laborious process, eventually ending with family is given parts of bodies, maybe a few bones, identified as their loved ones to bury. Every day someone is informed that the DNA test matches and the tears just flow. So the janaza salah is ongoing. Lots to speak about, but what shocked us all is when I asked the guide who was taking us around and speaking in a soft tone about the atrocities, I asked him what he knew about the massacre, and he said that when the Serbs were separating the women and children and sending them out of the town, he was right there. And the children under the age of 12 were allowed to leave. He was 13 and was told by soldiers to go left, go left, go left, as the queue of people were separated. Left meant that he would have to stay with the men, stay behind, and that meant death. In the chaos, he managed to take the hand of a few women that were passing away. He took the hand of one woman, and somehow the soldiers didn't notice, and he got onto the bus that took him to safety. He said that he had come to the edge of the line between life and death. You know, I got all choked up with emotion as I looked at him telling us this story. For all of us, it was a very, very deeply touching and moving visit to the beautiful town of Srebrenica, where so much of ugliness took place, man's inhumanity to man.
Now, I see you mentioned a lot of this on social media. Was this the effective way of getting the message across?
Well, my dear Maulana and dear listeners, you know, for the past few months, I wanted to tackle a very sensitive subject. I agonized over it many times. Should I deal with it or shouldn't I? It's a very sensitive subject, and there's a risk that people may get offended. People may even ostracize me. They may shun me in the streets, throw tomatoes at me, maybe even run me out of town. Some may even physically assault me. It was a great worry, but in the end I decided that, well, what the heck? You only die once. So, dear listeners, I'm going to put my head on the block and tackle this rather sensitive subject. But before I do that, let me say this. There are so many new innovations and advances, especially in science, from the days when people traveled on camels, huge leaps and bounds in the world of technology. Hence, from an Islamic paradigm, sometimes there are rigorous debates about new matters and issues that arise due to these advancements. For example, genetic engineering. There are so many discussions about this and amongst Muslim scholars and who sometimes agree and disagree on many aspects of this very complex topic. And so there are many such difficult issues and subjects that arise from time to time. In fact, I think things are going to be even more vexing. There are more vexing matters that will surface as a result of scientific advancement. So where is all this leading to, I hear you ask? And the answer is cell phones, but more especially social media. Let me say this out loudly. I hate social media. There it is, out in the open. But let me qualify it. I hate Muslim social media. Okay, let me qualify that even further. I hate Muslim social media groups. And let's refine that. I am speaking about WhatsApp groups. They drive me totally mad. Totally mad. I have been subscribed to a few. People just put me on to them. So the big question, why don't I just leave? Just delete myself from it. Why don't I just leave, eh? What's stopping me? Well, it's like this. Sometimes some people post some really wonderful stuff. Really wonderful stuff. Really insightful information or breaking news or alternative news. And I welcome your lectures also, Maulana, just for the record. That I like. So if I leave the group, I may miss this. But this is very rare in the group, the good stuff. The phone beeps and you check it and it's some irritating stuff. As I said in the beginning, there is no clear distinction about the etiquette of posting things in a group. Even an Islamic directive, for example, we don't even have that. It's all new, you see, new stuff, new technology. So now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to plunge into the deep end. I hope I don't drown. If you are on a few groups, then your cell is bound to beep and beep and beep every few minutes. So someone posts something. For example, if someone passes away, beep, the message comes onto your phone. So the message is, so-and-so passed away, janaza will be after Zohar. If it's some sort of an obscure person, not very well known, there will be no response, no reaction. But if it is some well-known person, maybe a big shot or some maybe kind, compassionate, pious person, then certainly there is a response. Let me pause here and ask this. Dear listeners, for all of your life, whenever, now listen carefully, whenever you heard that someone passed away, you immediately say, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. That we all know. You make this dua and Allah records it. Allah is hearing it. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala hears it immediately. That you said it. You heard the funeral message. You said vocally, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. So, why do you have to write it out on WhatsApp? Why? Yes, why? You said it aloud. Allah accepted it. Why post it on WhatsApp? Can someone please give me a rational, logical answer? So, you get the first beep. Inna lillahi wa inna, somebody writes. Then, after 30 seconds, another beep. You pull out your phone. Inna lillahi wa inna. From someone else. Then 45 seconds later, another beep. Take out your phone, inna lillah. And so on and so on. And you keep taking out your phone and it's the same message. After the 10th message, such message, you decide not to pull out your phone and look at the 11th beep because it must be the same message. But you are wrong because the 11th beep was Rukhsana saying, don't forget to bring clover sour milk for the curry khichdi. And then you go, oh, where's the mask? What mask, you ask very innocently. And anyway, to continue, sometimes a beep will give a different message. Something like, may he be granted the highest status in Jannah. Hey, Baba, lift your hands up and say it aloud. Make the dua. Allah is listening. Why post it on WhatsApp? The message, that message about the highest status is then followed by a response. Beep, somebody says Ameen. Then another beep, somebody else says Ameen. And then another one, and another, and another. So each time you pull out your phone, there is an Ameen. You are worried. You are worried. You are worried in case you don't check and Rukhsana sneaks up a message, don't forget to bring Danya. This is also nerve-wracking. So, my dear brothers and sisters, let me say this. With tears in my eyes, say it. Don't post it, okay? Say the dua. Don't post it on WhatsApp. But here's another thing that makes me grit my teeth. There is a joke. There may be a joke that was first heard in 1959. Since then, it was repeated over and over and over again until the whole world heard it. Except a small number of dear brothers and sisters. The joke by this time has hay growing on it. For example, a man from a farm in the Free State comes with his son to the big city for the first time. He enters a big building. He is fascinated by what he sees. It's a lift. A fat woman gets in. The door closes. After a few minutes, the door opens again. A slim young lady walks out. This is like magic. The father turns to the son and says, my boy, let's go home and fetch your mother. This joke is posted on WhatsApp group with a dozen smileys. That's what they are called, smileys. Dozen big laughing faces there. But it gets worse. The joke comes back after a few weeks from someone else. The same joke, someone else, and voila, a miracle. Now it's not a farmer, It's not a Free State farmer or anything. No, it's a Pakistani. Or Pakistani came to a big city and all. Or it's Julius Malema went up there and or maybe a Charo from Durban or something like that. You know, it's like modified now. The same old joke is modified. It makes my blood boil. And the name of the group clearly says what the subject. This is normal. You know, every group has a name. And the group clearly says what the subject matter is and therefore what should be discussed. For example, someone sets up a group about global warming. One by one, the contributions are posted on this group. Very nice ones. For example, statistics about how the ozone layer is being depleted, or maybe someone tells us how much pollution each country produces, or someone posts the view that sea levels are dropping and radiation is killing microscopic sea life. All very interesting and appropriate stuff. Then all of a sudden, a message appears. My Golf Chico has just been stolen from Gateway Shopping Center, ND398XYZ. Please call Imran 083-692XYZ. After half an hour, Imran replies, "Hey, sorry, I found it. I forgot that I parked it on the third level, not the second." But the worst is discussion about crime that takes the cake. Whew, there is a terrible murder, very bad murder somewhere. And then Yunus posts this. Hey, crime is out of control. Then Rashid says, yeah, it's very bad. Then Kasim posts this, a thumbs up sign. And Babu says, the police not doing their job. And Yunus says, you can't blame them. The crooks got more powerful guns. And then Rashid writes, the cops are in with the gangsters. And Kasim says, they're not paid well. Why should they risk their lives? And Babu says, then they shouldn't become cops. And Yunus says, you fellas are talking nonsense. We should help the cops. Ridwan puts another thumbs up. And Kasim says, crime is out of control. And so it goes on and on and on and on. The bottom line, some people have nothing to say, but that doesn't stop them from saying it. And your phone just beeps and beeps and beeps. And here's the one that really makes my non-existent hair stand up. No comments from you, Maulana. I call them the We Should crowd. The We Should crowd. Beep. I think we should stop paying our taxes because the government is stealing it. Beep. Another message. I think we should tell our government to invite Assad to South Africa, and when he is here, we should arrest him. Another beep. We should tell Trump that Islam is a religion of peace. He should study the Quran. Another beep. We should tell all the Muslim leaders to unite so that the Nasara will be afraid to attack us. The We Should lot really makes me bilious. And what about the dunce who sends you some absolutely sensational news? Sensational news. Just a week ago, if you remember, there was breaking news posted all over. Queen Elizabeth has died. And it's strange that CNN or BBC or Al Jazeera or none of the international newspapers had a word about this. But no, our jack-in-the-box poster got the news direct from Buckingham Palace, it would seem. And then, beep again, breaking news. Obama and Hillary had a love child. And the source, a Pakistani blogger. And then you get another beep. Beep, the Pope has accepted Islam. And the source, Sargeshwar Times. The worst character is the one who gets very excitedly post an article or picture on the group that someone sent him. Well, there's a small problem. If the Ulu read through the post, he would have noticed that the same picture or article was posted just 2 hours ago. I could just throttle him. Then there is the fellow who wants to sound very intelligent. So he uses big double-barrel words to impress. He doesn't call a cow a cow. He calls it a graminivorous ruminating quadruped with several stomachs. No one understands what he's saying. What about the character who has the complete hadith collection on his computer? Every day he will post one on every group that he is a member of, whether the group is about education in South Africa or the veteran cars discussion groups. And then we have the angry WhatsApp jihadist. Beep. Israel fired 2 missiles into Gaza. Beep from the angry one. Zionist pig dog, they will burn in hell. I can go on and on about what gives me severe heartburn on WhatsApp. But the one that takes the cake is the threatening messages. If you don't send this to 10 people, your eyeballs will fall out. Or you get the scary one. Do not eat guavas while driving a car, because it has been scientifically proven that doing so leads to increased accidents. But someone sent me this. Yes. So I think I'm going to finish off this. And it was on social media. Somebody sent me this, and it really got me laughing. And he captured this very well. Very funny indeed. The chap is from India, and he says this. I want to thank all my friends who have forwarded this chain message to me in 2012, 2013, 2014, and 2015, and still continuing. Because of your kindness, number one, I stopped eating. Oh, what happened here now? Because of your kindness, I stopped eating the tasty knickknacks after I heard that there was plastic in it. Number two, I stopped going to the movies for fear of sitting on a needle infected with AIDS. Number three, I forwarded hundreds of messages, but still I'm waiting for my free data balance. Number four, I smell like a rotten egg since I stopped using deodorants because they cause cancer. Number five, I also donated all my savings to a 7-year-old poor girl who was about to die in hospital about 700 times. I liked Emirates Facebook 100 times to get free first-class tickets. I have stopped drinking cola, as in every 6 months, one worker having AIDS dies in the Coke factory and his blood gets mixed in the Coke. If I don't take your call sometime, assume that my mobile is charging, and I fear getting burnt if I talk when mobile is charging, because every alternate day it is said somebody died of this as informed in chain message. But if you don't send this message to your friends in the next 10 seconds, a giant coconut might fall on your head tomorrow, even if you're in the middle of the ocean. And finally, WhatsApp is giving 5 kgs basmati rice and 2 liter milk. Share this message in only 5 groups and check the kitchen after 30 minutes. So, my dear listeners, my cell phone is fine when it is silent. I call it Sleeping Beauty. But when it makes the brain-chowing sounds, I call it the beeping slooty. Well, there you are, folks. My own personal view about WhatsApp. You may not like what I said, but please, please don't reject me. I have a very sensitive and very fragile ego. Samjhe? Be kind, okay? Amru.
Quick question. What do you think of Shimon Peres and the funeral and Abbas attending?
Well, the West is a great friend of Israel from the time that it was created, so it's natural that Western leaders should attend his funeral today. Peres is regarded as a great statesman and a valiant fighter and a man who spent his entire life devoted to his country. Hence, there are gushing obituaries and eulogies in the Western media. Except for a lone voice here and there, like Robert Fisk, who wrote this yesterday. It was in yesterday's Mercury newspaper. When the world heard that Shimon Peres had died, it shouted, "Peacemaker!" But when I heard that Peres was dead, I thought of blood and fire and slaughter. I saw the results. Babies torn apart, shrieking refugees, smoldering bodies. It was a place called Kana, and most of the 106 bodies, half of them children, now lie beneath the UN camp, where they were torn to pieces by Israeli shells in 1996. I had been on a UN aid convoy just outside the South Lebanese village. Those shells whished right over our heads and into the refugees packed below us. It lasted for 17 minutes. Peres, who was prime minister at that time, announced, "We did not know that several hundred people were concentrated in that camp. It came to us as a bitter surprise." It was a lie. The UN had repeatedly told Israel that the camp was packed with refugees. So, Robert Fisk, saying it like it was. That is, as we will hear in speeches today by Bill Clinton, maybe Prince Charles and Francois Oulu, and of course Mahmoud Bai, that is Mahmoud Abbas, will be there also attending. We will hear that he was that Therese was a very good and dedicated man. Well, yes, I must agree that he was. He was good and dedicated to Israel. But at huge cost to the Palestinians. Palestinian suffering has not stopped right from the start when Israel was created in 1948. And that was called the Nakba, the great tragedy, the catastrophe. Since then, the lives of Palestinians lurches from one tragedy to another, a never-ending nightmare. And Shimon Peres was a key player in this unabating human suffering, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize. What a cruel joke. And today he will be praised with words reserved for towering moral icons like Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela. Palestinians won't be sad today.
A quick word on the Saudi situation, Obama's veto overturned in the U.S.
Well, families of those who were killed on 9/11 wanted to sue Saudi Arabia for being behind the attacks on the Twin Towers. A law was passed to allow for this. Obama vetoed this, which he has the power to do as president. But the senators can overturn the veto if they get a two-third majority in the U.S. Senate. Well, this week they did, and so now the families can take the Saudis to court, and the whole thing could end up as the politics, as I say, the politics of unintended consequences. It could be a double-edged sword. What do I mean by this? Well, dear listeners, the court case could be quite intense and protracted, long drawn out with many witnesses being called, and in the end, it could open up the biggest can of worms in history. Imagine if all the dirty laundry came out and the Saudis managed to prove that neither they nor their citizens were responsible for 9/11. Then you would get the big question, so who then carried out the attack? Aha! You see what I mean? The U.S. has tried very hard to really look, not to look into 9/11. They ignored very compelling evidence. They turned a blind eye to the experts who voiced skepticism about what happened, even from respected scientists and engineers. But maybe all that could change dramatically. Watch that big can of worms. I like it.
I don't know if we need light at the end of the tunnel today. You made us laugh so much. Light at the end of the tunnel. Okay.
Ridwan went to the police station to report that his wife went shopping early in the morning, and now it's late in the evening and she has not returned yet. So the cop asked him for some information. He says, what is her height? And Ridwan says, no, I'm not sure, man. Okay, then what about her build? Is she tall or short? Is she fat or thin? Ridwan says, I think she's average. Okay, what about the color of her eyes? No, I didn't notice that. Okay, color of her hair. That changes from time to time. Okay, what was she wearing? Oh, I don't remember at all. Okay, what did she drive? Did she drive? Ridwan says, yes, she drives. She's got license. What kind of car? Ridwan says, it was a black Audi A6. Supercharged 3-liter V6 engine generating 333 horsepower with an 8-speed Triptonic automatic transmission with manual mode, and it has LED headlights which use light-emitting diodes for all light function and has a very thin scratch on the front left door.
Uncle Levy, as always, Jazakallah for your time. Much appreciated.
Always a pleasure, Balada.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's 9:11 minutes to 9. We go for a quick break. When we come back, it's the quiz with Maulana Daya.
The Big Picture program was sponsored by Steering Auto Inspector Car in Benoni, the thinking person's car dealership. Steering Auto, the home of pre-loved cars.